Hello and welcome to the Oregon Wine History Archive podcast. The Oregon Wine History Archive is located at Linfield University in McMinnville, Oregon, and is dedicated to preserving and sharing the Oregon wine story. This podcast shares these stories through oral history interviews we've conducted throughout the industry. Please enjoy today's episode.
All right. My name is Rich Schmidt. We're here with Dylan Glusker. It's February 9th, 2024, and we're at the Proof Rock Warehouse in Portland. Dylan, thank you so much for joining us today. And the first question, which I know has a complicated answer, is why wine?
Simple question, hard answer. Well, I've just kind of been led to wine on my path since college, I guess. I didn't know what I wanted to do going out of college, but I've always loved tasting things and been super fascinated with specialty foods particularly, and so I knew I wanted to use my palate to make some money, and I bopped around and tried a couple of things, but of course wine has this magnetic ability to draw in the right people, and I guess I was one of those people. Yeah, my mom's mom, when I was going through the early days in tea and chocolate, would always say, you know, you're gonna end up in the wine industry. You're gonna, and I'm like, yeah. Wine industry is for snobs, man. I'm never gonna do that. Here I am. So we made it. Yeah.
Tell me about life before wine. Tell me about where you're born and raised, and kind of path to school.
So I was born in the Bay Area. I was born in San Mateo, California, which is about 20 minutes south of San Francisco on the peninsula. My parents did not drink wine growing up, but they did like food in different capacities. They split up when I was pretty young, so I kind of got two separate lives. It's kind of trippy to think that like you have two bedrooms when you have like divorced parents and stuff, you know. But my dad was a foodie before foodies were a thing, so he would take us to, you know, San Mateo, California, actually a huge hub for traditional Japanese ramen. So I remember he would take us to hyped spots at like 10:30 in the morning, like breakfast time, and we'd be waiting in line. Or like he would know the spot that's like a door that leads to a staircase that leads to like the dankest stuff, you know. And he always had crazy cheeses in the house. So I was encouraged to like broaden my palate, even if I didn't always like it as a little kid. Whereas on the other end, my mom was very much like worked really, really hard for us, and would come home and make kind of a simple dinner, but she loved really good produce, like a fresh tomato. Like she had an eye for really excellent fresh vegetables and fruits. And in that regard, there's a lot of those flavors in wine, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. So I got that from them. And, throughout my life, my dad came from a very British upbringing. So whenever anything was going down, we had to have a hard talk, or we were just chilling on a Sunday afternoon. We were always making British tea. So always tea all the time, tea for every occasion. And, you know, when I went off to college, I was sent with like a kettle and, you know, tea bags and stuff. And I started college in Northern California at Humboldt State, which was beautiful part of the world. I was an English major in college, and it was in my sophomore year. I had a girlfriend who actually grew up in Portland and grew up here, and after winter break brought home a bag of oolong from Dao Tea, Phoenix Oolong. Still one of my favorite styles of tea. Don Song is the Chinese name. And I remember brewing that up and having my mind blown. It was just the most delicious flavor I'd ever tried. And I didn't even know how to brew loose leaf tea back in the day. I had to figure out like what vessel you buy and stuff, you know. And I became absolutely obsessed with Chinese tea specifically, maybe a little bit of Japanese tea, but I mean China is the origin of Camellia sinensis, the tea plant, and so I would spend hours and hours brewing tea in the kitchen, and my roommates would hate me because there was just spilled water everywhere and no one cared about it as much as I did. But I've always been that way. I've always like like I wasn't super great at school because I only kind of learn what I want to learn. It's very difficult for me to pay attention when I don't want to learn something. But when I do want to learn it, I become very, very, very invested in that topic. So I became that way for tea. And after my sophomore year, I was a little tired of Humboldt just because it was during the recession, California state schools had no money whatsoever. And Humboldt was very much a science-based school. So as a liberal arts major, I was a little out of luck. You know, I didn't feel like my classes were quite clicking with me. So I transferred to Portland State. Great choice because Oregon schools, it's like, what recession? It was all the resources in the world, very liberal arts based. So I took excellent classes, just super trippy poetry classes and stuff. It was great, very mind expanding. And in that time, kept up with tea and basically decided when I got out of college, I was going to do this in some capacity. And so I graduated, I'm doing everything I can. I got a job at Tea Chai Tay, and I worked at the Selwood location for, I don't know, maybe a couple years. I did not enjoy that job at all. It was very stressful, and there was like, I wasn't brewing the tea that I liked. I was making a lot of bubble tea, you know, no dissing on any of those things because people really like those things, but it wasn't what I was going for. But around that time, a spot called Flyawake Tea Garden opened up. And previous to that, I had been buying tea on the internet from China. And you know, you would buy it and you would wait like literally 8 weeks and it would arrive. And there were a couple American businesses, but not that much. And I had discovered Pu'er. I bought my first little Pu'er cake when I was living in Humboldt. And that is kind of where I decided, I was like, I'm not really selling that at Tea Chai Tay. I want to find a place where I can really focus on doing this. And so, hard cut, what is Pu'er, right? It's crazy. So in China, there's a lot of tea. And in southwestern China, there's a province called the Yunnan province, a very rural province, and in this region it's traditional to press tea into cakes. And whereas in other parts of China and Taiwan, tea is sort of only grown to be the size of a bush, so you know, more yield, higher yield, more productivity, in Yunnan a lot of the tea comes from wild tea trees, which is of course fascinating to think about. So they're picking from these ultra prime tea trees and they process them and press them into cakes in such a way that there is still a little bit of microbial activity that continues in the tea cake. And this allows the cakes to age. It's like wine. In fact, it's more effective than wine. There are Pu'er cakes that are over 100 years old that are still drinking. The oldest one I've had a couple from the 50s that were drinking amazing, like better than any wine I could ever think of would be drinking from the 50s. So it's this fascinating topic that I was like, oh man, I need to figure out a way to get deeper into this. And prior to that, the internet had very little about it. You could buy some from like China or from like a couple Western facing dealers. But when this spot opened up in Northeast Portland, I was just like, oh my God, I'd never seen another person who knew what this was. So here, let me show it to you guys. So this is a Pu'er cake. I tried to find the ones that were like the most intact from my collection. So it comes in like a frisbee shape. This is what's called a bing cha, and traditional weight is 357 grams. So this is a factory tea. So this is not a small producer. This would be like a big corporate type producer, but known for incredibly high quality. The producer is called Dai Yi. And they inhabit the Menghai Tea Factory, a very classic tea factory. So it's actually very interesting. This is like a really benchmark style of Pu'er tea because they have a recipe. The recipe was created in 1975. Average leaf grade is 7. And Menghai Tea Factory is factory number 2. Kunming Tea Factory, factory number 3, I think. Zha Guan up in Dali is tea factory number 3. So that's how it works in the most basic sense. But this is one of the biggest producers, arguably overpriced, but I still had to buy it. I liked the dogs around the outside, specifically on the 18. But here, let's see if we can focus in on this. This is what the pressed tea looks like inside. And this is what's called a ripe pour or a chaud pour, which is an accelerated fermentation method that was invented in the 70s. So this is based off of like one of the earliest examples of this style of tea. But if you are not going to accelerate the aging, you get what is called a sheng pour. This is a producer called Xuanjiang Mengku. And they're from different part of Yunnan. But look, you can see it goes from being black to being much more green. That being said, this is a 2018 back here, and this is a 2012. So this is aging much slower. And even though the ripe pours are meant to taste like they're older, they just kind of taste like ripe pours. It's two very different styles. So anyways, Final Flower Wake, I was like, damn, I'm going to stay here all the time, hang out with Kevin, drink tea all the time. And that's basically what I would do all my waking hours. I would just be there. Like, I think he told me that I'd would drink over a gallon of tea there. I would just empty out his whole hot water container and he would just fill it back up. So we would hang out all the time. And he at one point gave me a deal so I could leave Tea Chai Tay. He said, do you want to be a chai walla? He made this chai that he called the guru's chai. He learned this recipe from his guru in India, and he would make it from scratch every morning. It was amazing, though I'm not really a big chai person, but he said, if you want to, we'll buy you a box with wheels on it, and we'll put pumpers of chai, and if you want to attach that to your bicycle, because I was biking everywhere back then, never had any money, but he said, if you want to attach that to your bicycle and ride around Northeast and sell chai by the cup to people, I'll give you free tea and $25 a day. And this was Portland of, 2013, 2014. So, like, you know, you could scrape with that. And that was my first sales job. Way harder than selling wine. I'll tell you that much, man. Like, imagine cold calling, every single person ever. But I got to know all the business owners on Williams, Mississippi, Alberta, Chloe Udaly, former city commissioner, I think, here in Portland, used to own a business on Mississippi called Reading Frenzy. She was consistently 10 to 15 minutes late to work every day, so I would make my rounds down Mississippi, sell a bunch of chai, and then come back, and Chloe Udaly liked the small business, so she would always hook it up. But yeah, doing that, representing Flyer Wake, now I would go back and Kevin and I would nerd out about pu'er tea. And, you know, eventually you can only make no money for so long. So I found another job. I had known about cacao in downtown Portland because I had an aunt and uncle in Seattle who loved craft chocolate. And so I was aware that it existed, aware that cacao existed. And I had a friend who was working there, actually. So when I was out dropping off resumes, I stopped into cacao and dropped off a resume. And lo and behold, got an interview. It was the best interview I've ever had because they had me taste things and list flavor profiles, which I was just like, this is the most fun interview ever. So I didn't even really take it all that seriously because I was like, you know, it was great. They brewed me a cup of Darjeeling tea, but you know, I was just there to have fun. And they gave me the job, which was excellent because it's probably one of the greatest places someone with an aspiring palate could ever have worked. It was a 6-week training program. You tasted every single thing in the store. They taught you how to describe things concisely. They taught you how to sort of contextualize your palate. So I was good at tasting things, but they really they motivated me and gave me a framework to taste better and speak better. I also learned that I love selling expensive chocolate retail. You know, I could convey my enthusiasm for it to people, and you tell people what they need to have and why they need to have it, and they buy it from you. And I was like, dang, that's actually, I think I could do this. You know, chai, selling chai kind of hard, selling chocolate pretty easy. But in that time, I got really familiar with the world of craft chocolate, which is quite a small world, quite a young industry in North America. But I got to the point where I could blind taste origins and producers. So it's just like wine, where each origin has its own distinct character. Each producer has its own distinct style. And it becomes pretty apparent when you've eaten enough of it. It's a fascinating food. So I brought some chocolate because I had to do some show and tell. We'll start with Bonnat. Bonnat, actually quite an old producer because they're French. This is a really classic producer. So ideally, dark chocolate would be cacao, sugar, and nothing else. That's called two-ingredient chocolate. Optionally, you could add back more of the cacao butter or the fat from the chocolate and make it super smooth. And that is exactly what Bonnat likes to do. That is their whole thing, is to make the smoothest, most luxurious chocolate on earth, which I love. So when this interview was coming up, I was like, where can I find some Bonnat? It took me a long time to find it, but this stuff is really good. And then on the other end of the spectrum, just like you know, Burgundy has a lot of tradition, but then you'll taste a young producer that's just like turning this like ancient and storied region on its head, and it just blows your mind. There's that in chocolate too, if you can believe it. So Soma is a producer out of Toronto. They are not particularly a new producer. They've been around for quite a while, but these guys to me represent sort of the cutting edge of new school craft chocolate. So please go out and buy it. It's so much cheaper than a bottle of wine. That's the other cool thing. It's like people will spend whatever on a bottle of wine, which is excellent. I love it. But like this, I think $12, you know, represents one of the best bars of chocolate in the world. Like you can taste the best of this specialty food in the entire world for $12, which I think is pretty amazing. I get hired on a cacao. I'm having a great time tasting everything. It was incredibly formal, and I'm not a very formal person, so I kind of had to play that game. But one of the owners there was a good friend of Alice Firing. So he gave me Alice Firing's book about how she, you know, went to war with Robert Parker or whatever. And, you know, I knew that I should probably get into wine at some point because I was, what, like 22 or 23, and I was like, okay, maybe I should be a little bit more mature. So I had, like, actually pretty trippy because I turned 21 living in Oregon, and prior to that, growing up in California, I had only ever tasted Cabernet or Zinfandel based wines. Like, because my parents didn't drink wine, so it's like when I tasted a wine, it was only Cabernet or Zinfandel based. So I go to a shop to buy my first bottle of legal wine, and they sell me a Pinot Noir, and I take it home, and I just remember it just like so much like it was so different than anything I had ever tasted. Yeah, it was, I had no context for it whatsoever. But when Aubrey gave me Alice Firing's book, I started exploring more of the classic wine regions because she lists them very clearly in her book, and she gives recommendations for good producers. So the world of wine is so huge that when I started out, I didn't know where to start. You know, what does Safeway have? You know, I didn't know where to find even wine stores or anything like that. But, you know, reading a little bit helped, going on the internet helped, and then slowly but surely I became obsessed, like I did with tea, like I did with chocolate, and I was suddenly reading everything that I could. I would go onto the Vinopolis website and endlessly read the critic reviews, because Vinopolis has like critic reviews for like super fancy Bordeaux and Burgundy and stuff like that. And I was like, what are the flavor profiles that can exist in wine? And I discovered a couple places that a couple good wine shops, divisive wine shop, but Well, I should say it was great for me because the margins were super low, but Europa wine shop that existed downtown, spent so much money there, but their margins were super duper duper slim. So I got to experience a lot of Europe that way. Park Avenue opened up just before I joined the industry. And I was there all the time because these were downtown. I could, like, on my lunch break at Cacao, I could walk over there and nerd out with them and buy a bottle of wine or go to their tastings or whatever. And so eventually I, you know, knew that that's where I needed to end up. I needed to be in wine. That's fine. So I don't know how I got these names, but I wanted an informational interview with a couple of people. So I actually reached out to John Suarez over the phone. He said, email me. And I was like, I kind of want to meet you in person. That's okay. But I reached out to Tim Ripa from Petit Monde. Tim Ripa, kindest dude ever, set up an appointment for us to meet at a coffee spot on Williams. He was 45 minutes late, but when he showed up, he was the most gracious, gracious person ever. He had all the names, all the phone numbers, answered every single question that I had, gave me all the time in the world. And he told me that Josh, here at Proof Rock, my boss, was hiring for a delivery driver. And of course, I knew about wine distribution at that point. I knew that that's what I wanted to get into because, like with tea or chocolate, I've always liked to be surrounded by a lot of whatever I like. So massive quantities of wine sounded epic to me. So, and also distribution is fun because, like I said, like retail felt easy for me. Like you can tell anyone what they want and they'll buy it. You know, charisma sells, but distribution is harder. Being a sales rep is harder because you're playing in the big leagues. Like you're playing with people who have seen your kind before and know the tech, know the stats, know the soil type, like impress them. And that seemed much more fascinating and difficult to me. And that's what I wanted to do. So getting hired onto Proof Rock initially was a bit of a push just because I really wanted to be in sales. And Josh smartly told me I was not ready to be in sales. I thought I knew something about wine, but I didn't know much at all about wine at that point. You know, I didn't know what the marquee was, you know? So I needed to learn a lot before that came. So I started as a driver, which I think is the best way to enter the wine industry. 100% is the best way, at least with distribution, best way to enter distribution, because you are the least intimidating person as a driver. And if you show interest and you're friendly, you'll make a lot of friends as a driver. Like I would, you know, roll up to places and be like, oh, you have that on glass pour right now. I had that. You would get tastes of stuff and like, you know, you would make friends with, you know, whatever the chef, and they would give you some potato chips because you never had any money for lunch anyways. Yeah. Yeah. New Seasons, man. New Seasons, they have these like things called blue slips and I think that's what they're called. And it's like just expired, like salads and stuff. And I'd be like, oh man, what you got for lunch? I'd know all the receivers. Yeah. So, but like, it's great because you get to talk with all these people about wine, all these great minds about wine, and you are not in business with them. So you're just completely their friend. That being said, you're making no money whatsoever. So I needed to figure out how to make the ends work so I can stay in this long enough to become a rep. And so I reached out to Mr. Jeffrey Weisler of Pairings Portland, Portland's weirdest wine shop and bar, where I still work every Friday, 5 years later. I was living in that neighborhood at the time, and Jeffrey hooked me up with a job, super kind. So I was able to make a little supplemental income there. And that was great, because I was back in retail and I could pour wine for people, which I had never done before, and it was wacky. And whereas Proof Rock was very much like systematic and, you know, do everything in your power not to make mistakes, we have to be efficient. Because when I was hired on here in 2015, we were a two-person company. It was Josh and me. Josh was doing absolutely everything and I was just delivering it all. So it was incredibly high pressure for him at the time, and, you know, it was imperative that we keep this thing going. So pairings was the complete opposite. You can mess up all you want. There were no rules. Just have fun and make sure that the customers have fun. Pour the wine. get money and then leave. And so it's always been a perfect counterbalance for me that, like, here I can really focus on being an efficient salesperson. And, you know, it's become very fun for me over the years because I've gotten to know the job better. But at Pairings, it's just a party, basically. So highly recommend you guys go sometime. So in 2019, after calling on New Seasons for a couple of years, that was kind of my first toe in the water of sales repping. Our sales rep who Josh had hired on left, and I became a full-time sales rep. That was in August of 2019. My first day of repping was my 27th birthday, which is pretty crazy. And then we all know what happened the next year. So I got a taste of what repping was like, you know, regular restaurant appointments, you know, balancing your schedule and everything. And then suddenly it went to, I was the only person, basically. Josh had no restaurants to call on, and I had all of the grocery, and grocery saved us. Man, there were a lot of distributors that didn't have a big grocery presence, and it hurt them a lot. But so all throughout the pandemic, every day I was going out to, you know, 8 grocery stores a day when they told you don't go to the grocery store. And it was incredibly stressful, but I've always really valued small business. I would be curious to work at a big business one day because I never have, but I've always understood that, like, in a small business, you got to keep it going no matter what. You know, I always understand how resourceful we have to be and how tenacious we have to be. And so that was the pandemic for us. Our driver couldn't work. We still paid him, actually, which was amazing. Josh kept him on the payroll, but he had a father in a nursing home, so he couldn't be out in the world. So it was Josh and I delivering everything, me writing all the orders for that time, and, you know, taught me to suck it up and make it happen, make it work. And when things started freeing up, I was due for Josh was nice to me and he sent me to Croatia and Slovenia in 2021, which was amazing. So here at Proof Rock Wines, we work with an importer called Vinum USA, based out of New Jersey. And they make semi-regular trips with sort of typically principals or of distribution companies who they work with throughout the United States. But Josh snuck me in as a rep, which was kind of nice. So I got to travel, and this was the first time I had traveled to a foreign country's wine regions before. Actually, I've never been to France, never been to Italy. You know, I've tasted in California plenty of times, all over, tasted in Oregon, but I'd never tasted wine in Europe, and it was amazing. It was fascinating. It was, but it was also so natural. Like, wine, as soon as I'm tasting something, I can relax. You know, that's why I'm so nervous right now. I don't have chocolate in my mouth. But as soon as I'm tasting, I'm relaxed. I could be in another country completely jet lagged or whatever, but as soon as we're talking about, you know, the new vintage of the rosé, it's like, yeah, you could talk with anyone in the world. So, but absolutely fascinating, eye-opening. Croatia has the best cheap beer brand in the world, in my opinion. It's called Karlo Vacka. If any beer distributors are watching this, please bring in Karlo Vacka. I will pay double. Beyond that, I got to see an entirely different landscape, an entirely different culture of winemaking. It was fantastic. And it made me so much more knowledgeable about these really fringe wines that we sell because, you know, there's, you know, everyone can butt heads about how much they know about Burgundy, but I think it's way cooler to support up-and-coming wine regions like Styrska in Slovenia. You know, excellent vineyards. Some of the exposures there can just have the potential to create some of the best wines in the world in the future. But for a long time, Yugoslavia, my impression is that it's been very insular. Everyone's just tasted the wines that come from within their own country or their own region. And the world wines have not really been on their radar. Like over there, talked about Oregon Pinot Noir, very, very, very few people had ever tasted Oregon Pinot Noir. And it was actually pretty fascinating to taste the Pinot Noir in northeastern Slovenia because it was Pinot Noir made by someone who had never tasted a California or Oregon Pinot Noir before. So it was like, whoa, like the acidity was completely different. It was wild.
We'll catch you back up there in a second, but I want to back up for a little bit. You mentioned sort of your once you find something that you're interested in, you dive all the way in. So tell me about your own kind of personal wine education. When you started working here, when you started as a driver here, how far along were you on kind of the wine education? And what had you sort of done to teach yourself at that point?
Well, there were a lot of, I mean, it's all online. I always tell everybody you can throw thousands of dollars at GuildSom, but it's all online for free. I mean, like, the pin matters. It does. Yeah, absolutely. But I had learned everything on the internet because it literally is all on the internet. And there are YouTube videos all over. And I'd watched every documentary. And, like, there are plenty of books, too, but I didn't read a lot of books. Europa, that shop that I mentioned earlier, actually had a wonderful website where every single wine they sold had a history of the region, the variety, and the producer on it. It was excellent, so I read every single one of those. And then I realized if I wanted to enter the wine industry, I had to have some sort of, like, degree or something, so I took WSET 2. Which was a bit of a snoozer, but you should take it if you don't know anything about wine, but it's pretty simple. And so I had that under my belt, and that's still all that I have under my belt in terms of accreditation or whatever, just because, you know, they don't really teach you about, like, Styrian Sauvignon. Maybe they do, but you know, I learn all this stuff on my own, so I don't really want to pay for it. So coming into Proof Rock, that's all I had, and I wasn't going to stop learning. I realized that I had to learn a lot. So, and it's still to this day what I do and what a lot of people in the wine industry do. If you get caught up not knowing something or saying something wrong, you never do it again because you're so ashamed that you could not know, like, the soil type and this one part of Cinque Terre and, like, oh, you know, blah, 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 blah. So you go home and you study where all the schist is and, you know, blah, blah. So I learned incredibly quickly about a lot of these wines and producers, but even as a driver, you don't have the money to buy and taste all of them. So really, it's not until I was a rep and I was perpetually taking out bag after bag of wines and tasting a lot of wines that way. So I think the most important thing anyone in the wine industry can do is put themselves in a situation where you're tasting as many wines as you can all the time. And don't be dogmatic either. Like, I'm a pervert in that I love Safeway wine every once in a while, like mega purple me up, you know? But of course, a lot of the people I sell to and a lot of the wine, you know, this culture would be pretty offended by that. So it's like, work at a wine bar, rep, but you're really only getting one aesthetic of wine. Like, taste all the aesthetics of wine. When I was working in chocolate, cacao was a very, very curated selection, but at staff meetings, they would give us bars that they rejected. And they said, it's just as important to taste bad chocolate as it is to taste good chocolate. And that's incredibly true with wine, because there are a lot of wine profiles that people might think are bad, like Morgier de la Salle in Val d'Aoste. That Prié Blanc tastes like chlorine in a cool vintage. Less so now, but, like, it is a weird, weird profile, and a lot of people would think that that's off, but that's actually, like, peak expression. That's quality. So I think finding what makes a bad wine and what makes a good wine is really difficult, yeah. But, yeah, basically, yeah, I was interested in it, so I learned all of it. And I feel like to be in the industry, you have to have that. I feel like you have to crave the knowledge all the time.
You talked earlier about sort of the jump from sort of retail face-to-face sales to distribution as being kind of the step into the big league. So tell me about learning that, and what did you not know? What did you have to learn on the road about selling wine at that level?
everything. And Josh was great because he told me a couple of things, but he kind of just like let me go out. And what I've realized is, as a salesperson, everyone has their own style. Everyone sells differently. Everyone, you know, because it's all about comfort and creating relationships with these people, not being, you know, you could be uptight and sterile when it's like a really high, you know, important meeting or whatever. But with your regular accounts, it's about creating a flow that comes naturally from you and not from everything that you've been trained to do. So initially, yeah, I'd be walking up to these big accounts and sitting down and not really knowing what extended maceration was, or, you know, mixing up stuff, or, you know, not knowing. I feel like now, since I still work at Pairings, sometimes I'll do some buying when Jeffrey is gone, and meeting with reps, I see it. Like, I never really hear other reps talk, but yeah, it's what tech you're told by some reps is very interesting too. So yeah, you kind of got to learn what people wanted to hear, and you do sound kind of like you sound very green for very long until you don't. And I think that that's the same with everything. And, you know, you see a lot of people who try being a sales rep for a couple of years and they get frustrated, then they leave because they don't get what they want out of it. And it doesn't work that way. You plant a tree and you're cultivating, like, you know, 60 trees basically, and you can't let them die. But they're also very small for a long time. You kind of, but as they grow, so do your commissions. Yeah. But I could not be more thankful for the job that I have, because think of it, like, you have any question about wine, like, because, you know, you're thinking about wine all the time. I think about wine I dream about wine. Like, I dream about buying wine like 5 times a week. I taste wine in my dreams, all the time. And you come up with these questions. What do you do with these questions? Well, I can ask it to my boss, who's been in the industry for 20 years. I can go around to the head buyers of a million different restaurants and ask them the same questions and get, you know, 7-8 different answers. And, you know, you can expand your wine knowledge immensely by being a sales rep. So it's, I'm just so gifted to have been given this opportunity. I don't know. Yeah.
So tell me about the specific wines here. You mentioned kind of some fringe areas and up-and-coming areas.
That's right.
Before your trip to Europe, tell me about getting to understand wines that were not so easily understood.
Well, Josh would point out a lot of them. I would also be curious about a lot of them because I'd never seen it before. The first bottle I ever took home was actually from a Croatian producer in northeastern Croatia. There's a region called Slavonia, not to be mixed up with Slovenia, but Slavonia is actually where a lot of the oak that is used in Croatian winemaking and Italian winemaking comes from. It's kind of ironic that the Italians skip over Slovenia and go straight to Croatia to get their oak, but the Slovenians would never use Croatian oak. They only use Slovenian oak. It's very confusing. But anyways, Ivan and Yingi, who I actually got to visit on my trip, he was the last stop. I was so stoked. This is a really old school natural producer, apparently uses kind of high sulfur, but everything else is completely natural. And it was unlike anything I'd ever tasted. It was a Grauschervina or Welsh Riesling. It had botrytis, $13. I think it's $14 now. But, you know, there was so much that I'd never seen before, and I was in it to taste all the stuff that I haven't seen before initially. And I was blown away by it. And now that I've been in the industry longer, I'm a snob and I only try to buy like nice regions and stuff. But at the same time, it's incredibly important that we kind of shepherd these smaller regions so that they become like epic in the future. Because, you know, and Yingi may always be cheap, but, like, you know, Croatian wines maybe $10-$20 more expensive in the future. You know, Slovenian wines, I think there's a huge potential in Oregon. Northeastern Slovenian wines, I wouldn't be surprised if that's a much more expensive region in the future when more people discover it. And it's certainly growing, you know. But at the same time, I explored all of them, and yes, I kind of am a bit more of a snob now, but, like, I drink all the Friuli I can because I explored all these crazy regions and I found that I love Friuli, you know, and it's not something that you initially reach for when you're learning about wine, but you find the regions that you're, the fringe ones that you really fall in love with along the way. I guess Friuli, not super fringe, but yeah.
And how'd you go about communicating that? Obviously, you have to sell these wines to people who may not, or also may not be familiar with them. So tell me about learning the story well enough to sell the wines.
Yeah, so, I mean, looking at maps, of course, like a lot of people, you have to explain where Croatia is, where Slovenia is, Bosnia, Serbia. And sort of give them a context of how it relates to Italian wine culture, how it relates to, you know, I guess a lot of those things you kind of relate to Italy. But Dalmatian coast of Croatia, I mean, it's very relatable to California with the Zinfandel connection. Zinfandel initially comes from Croatia. It's called Cyrilianac Kaštelenski, which is a total mouthful. But any Californian, any fan of Californian wine would absolutely love Croatian wine. So you kind of find where it's analogous. People know that it's different and people are curious about the ways in which it's different. So even though that you don't put them on a retail shelf and people just walk up and grab them, I would say, God, 9 out of 10 consumer-facing tastings that I do are Slovenia and Croatia. So that, you know, because it's always teaching. It's always very educational. You know, people know that they've had a good Chianti or a Cote d'Rhone, you know, so you don't really need to push that on them, but introducing them to this new region, people, you know, are almost always really stoked to have discovered it because they're delicious wines, and especially a lot of Croatian wines are very accessible to the American palate. So I've found that it's been really easy, but it's also, people don't think to buy Croatian wine all the time, so you do have to push it, but once you do, people are super happy about it. Yeah. And that's the other interesting thing about working both retail and distribution. Like, just a little bit of retail on Friday night goes such a long way, because you can talk and be nerdy with wine people all you want. Like, wine people know all the regions you're talking about. They know all the words and stuff like that, all the trends. But a consumer doesn't, you know? And no one teaches you how to talk about flavor profiles. No one had training at Cacao to like, what fruit flavor is it, blah, 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 blah. Like, they don't know what they're asking for, but they do kind of, so to talk to customers and see what they're asking about, you get really surprised, you know, and sort of being like shepherding them towards certain cool things is very important. But I'm also surprised, like our Slovenian producer, Rodica, more people pull up pictures of Rodica wines on their phone than I ever thought, you know, and it's cool to see, because I didn't see that 3 or 4 years ago. So it is catching on. You know, there's a little bit of traction, and it's really cool that I've been to that place, and I'm like one of the people who gets to present that to Oregon. Yeah. Yeah. One of the, actually the best wine I tasted when I took that trip in 2021 was at the Rodica Winery. Beautiful place. They had a Civi Pinot, a Pinot Grigio, skin contact Pinot Grigio that I tasted. It was the 2017 vintage, and it just stopped me in my tracks. It was the best wine I tasted of the whole trip. And I turned to the owner of Vinum, and I was like, this, I really want to bring this. I've never seen this in America. This needs to come back to America. And he was like, all right, I'll see what I could do. And we talked to Matt Tietz, who was the head winemaker there, and he said, oh no, we don't export this one, not enough. And I was like, Ilya, please work on these guys, we need this in America. Lo and behold, comes to America. I think we get 4 cases for all of Oregon, but like, to take that wine out and see all of these people's eyes just like blow up, it's special, man.
You talked a bit about the sort of the evolution of your work, obviously starting as a driver, working all the way up through, and with a little COVID break in the middle, changing things up. Tell me about the biggest steps for you along the way. Were there moments, were there events, were there times when you felt like you'd sort of taken a step forward or reached a milestone along the way?
When I got to know people well enough that they were giving me discounts on my wine, that was good. honestly, the biggest event that was like, damn, I've made it, is right before I became a rep, Josh took me to IPNC. And someone at Brooks got me a ticket. So thank you to Brooks Winery. And we went to the Salmon Bake. And I had never been surrounded by like such luxury before. And like everywhere you met, like we sat at a table with Rex Hill and Johan and like, you know, just the cream of the crop of winemaking. And I was like, wow, I'm part of this now. Like, you know, I deserve to be here. You know, sitting next to this really interesting guy, longtime critic of Austrian wines, and Michael Malott, our producer, was there. So yeah, I was just surrounded by, you know, I was no longer just kind of the person who you'd grumble at and throw a check at, you know, like people wanted to, were happy to talk to me. And I was so surprised as a driver or as a rep that like you set an appointment and people pay attention to you. They give you respect for the first time ever. As a driver, you show up and like, you know, treat your drivers better. In the city, people do. Like, Le Pigeon, you always got treated amazingly as a driver. You know, they're a class act. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, they don't want to be bothered from prep or whatever like that. But as a rep, you walk in someplace and they're ready for you and they know your name and stuff like that and put water out in front of you. And that's like miles above where I was before. So that was a big thing. I mean, you know, of course, getting to go to Croatia and seeing stuff that I had picked come back, seeing some of the suggestions that I had made to winemakers change in the way that their labels looked or whatever, you know, was wild. Yeah, there was one winemaker who had these super cool black and white labels, and he himself is kind of a black and white type of brooding guy, but his labels previously had been like psychedelically colored, and I said to him at a dinner, I was like, man, this isn't you. Like, you know, these labels are sick. They look like, you know, like goth tattoos, you know, and that's kind of more your vibe. And he was like, you know, you're right. And boom, next year, no more color on his labels, all these really cool skull labels. And I was like, hell yeah. We don't carry that producer, unfortunately, but the wines are awesome. But man, specific moments, I don't know. I'm just reminded why I'm in the industry often, because who goes into work in a bad mood and leaves in a great mood? You know, I'll come to work and, you know, won't have slept well or don't feel great or whatever. And then you go and you see your accounts and you love these people so much. And it's just such a good exchange and you're laughing and, you know, the business is just so easy. It just doesn't feel like work, you know, and you come home and you're just stoked by what you got to do that day and what you got to pour and who you got to talk to, and all the new information you learned. And I think that more so than any landmarks for me, it's just like, I'll be reminded often how exciting it is to do what I do.
So you talked about kind of balance, how you have to sort of balance the work you do, balance your days. Tell me about a typical day or a typical week for you. I'm curious, like, how do you sort of plan out what you're going to do and make sure it all fits?
Man, that was the hardest part about becoming a rep, because they don't tell you about the early days of becoming a rep, but they're just like, here are all your accounts, go out and see all of them. And of course, none of your accounts know who you are. So you send out 60 emails the first week and you get like two appointments and then you're just twiddling your thumbs. And yeah, it takes a really long time to cultivate to the point where I've gotten where I actually get emails back from people consistently. But what I'll do is I choose six wines that I want to take out as samples, and you know, I'll send them to Josh's requests and he'll be like, no, 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 yes, no. And then I'm like, okay, back to the drawing board, send him six more. And he's like, okay, those will work. You can take those out. And then you just start reaching out to the people who fit your bag, right? If it's a more natural bag, you reach out to your natural accounts. If it's an Italian bag, you reach out to your Italian accounts. If it's a classic, you know, bag, you reach out to the accounts that just like the classic regions. And try to reach out to, you know, 16, 20 accounts with the hopes of getting 8 appointments. And then, of course, Wednesday comes and, you know, you've booked out half your day, but, you know, you'll look at your email and someone can taste that once, and you're speeding from like the east side to the west side to like get that tasting appointment because you want it. So it's incredibly dynamic. It's never really, when a week is set in stone, it's pretty rare. But you do always have your grocery stores that you need to drop into. So there is a bit of a rhythm and a flow. But in terms of landing tasting appointments with people, it's kind of, yeah, very dynamic. And it's, for instance, I had a coworker at Pairings who was doing a wine program and wanted to shadow me for a day. And I found it impossible to know which day I could bring her around just because, like, I didn't know how many appointments I would have in a day. They seem to just materialize for me. So, but I stay super busy all the time. Like when I was a rep, I didn't always have a place to go. Like, you know, and now, despite how, you know, willy-nilly my schedule is, I always have a place that I need to jet off to next, which is great. And it took a very long time to cultivate that. So I can once again see why early days for a lot of reps are really frustrating and you're really kind of bored, and then suddenly, you know, it snowballs. So yeah, but there's no good answer for that. I just hope and pray that I fill my week, and then I do. Most of the time, almost all the time now, yeah, I do.
So to change track a little bit here, I know Oregon wine is not the focus of your work, but obviously you're here in Oregon wine country. And so tell me about, you mentioned sort of first impressions of Pinot Noir being completely, I have a very similar story of my first impression of Oregon Pinot Noir. So it's very, very much the same line. I have no idea what this is. I have no idea how to relate to this. How have you, what is your kind of relationship with Oregon wine now, and how have you observed it in the times you've been here?
Fascinating question. Yeah, so, I drink a lot of Oregon wine, and I am very proud to be an Oregonian now, because I've lived here for, you know, over a third of my life, so. Hopefully I could call myself an Oregonian. I've really fallen in love with Oregon Pinot Noir because I've tasted so much of it and I kind of know what I like. I know the diversity that exists, and not just Oregon Pinot Noir, you know, Oregon Chardonnay, like your interview with Andrew Rikers. I was like, damn, Andrew Rikers. Like Seth Morgan Long, you know, like some of the best Chardonnays I've had, period. Like the first, the first time I met Seth Morgan Long, he may not remember, but I was trying to taste William Oban on something, and he was sitting there with a bottle of 14 Rouleau Meursault Premier Cru, and then Seth's Seven Springs, is that the vineyard, Chardonnay, tasting them side by side. I'm like, qualitatively quite similar. That's crazy. So, you know, I get so stoked about what's going on here. Not to mention, I mean, I was listening to Andrew Riker's interview, and he was talking about older Oregon Pinot Noir, and he did not want to name names of the shops where he buys older stuff. But Murray at Great Wine Buys, I'm going to blow him up because he's got a lot of old stuff. So, like, that's how I tasted, you know, a 1999 J.K. Carrier, which is their first vintage, which was drinking amazingly, you know, some old Cameron. He had the pre-Maggie Harrison Antica Terras for $50 a bottle, and not even like the 500, because I think they were originally 500 mils. He had 750s at $50 a bottle. I was like, easy peasy. Yeah, so, you know, it ages, and of course there's like all this stuff going on in the gorge too. I mean, back to Andrew, he has Missoula floods, and that stuff is insane. I've tasted some of those wines, and when I first heard about it, I was like, oh my god, like, is that expensive? Like, it can't be worth that much. And then, like, I taste it, I'm like, oh my god. Yeah, and then, you know, all the creative stuff that Jeff Veer does in the gorge. At Pairings, we've carried almost every Jeff Veer wine ever, so I've tasted his evolution. But what's really interesting, yeah, it's like I haven't been in the industry for super long, but I've seen regions change. Like, you know, when I first started drinking the Loire, it was 11, 12, 13, 14. And then 15 came along and I was like, what happened to the acidity in these white wines, man? But like back when I first started drinking Oregon Pinot, it was much more common to get Brett in Pinot, I feel like. And you don't get as much Brett in Oregon Pinot anymore. And, you know, I've seen things change and, you know, Irie stayed at $33 for a long time and they are no longer $33, unfortunately. So in that regard, I've seen the industry change, but yeah, it's excellent to, and you can go down and taste in the valley and, you know, being industry, it's just like cheating. You get it for free. You know, it's like the assistant winemaker comes out or the winemaker comes out and chills with you and you can nerd out with them. Yeah, my girlfriend hates it, but you know, I drag her along. I try to find the places like Beckham or something where they have like sheepdogs or something, like, you know, she likes checking out like the animals and stuff. But meanwhile, I'm like in the vineyard like this close to a vine, you know. But yeah, so in that regard, yeah, I don't just focus on European wine, and definitely as far as New World wine goes, I drink more Oregon than anything else, just because they're the people I interact with on a day-to-day basis, you know, and I think that what we do here is very special. Man, I keep coming back to that Andrew Riker's interview. I don't know why, but that was a great interview. He's such a smart dude. But he was talking about, you know, don't compare it to Burgundy. Don't stop comparing it to Burgundy. It's not Burgundian. Stop saying Burgundian. It's Oregon wine. And after hearing that, you know, it's like I've done that before. And come to think of it, it's like, yeah, our AVAs are incredibly different and incredibly unique. And sure, there are similarities because it's all Pinot Noir. But like, enjoying what is us and trying to find what is us and where we're going, because there's such potential in the future, is really exciting. So I try to check in and keep up with what's going on and what's cool in Oregon wine as well. But most of the time I'm drinking Europe.
Well, as long as we're talking about what is next and what is the potential, tell me about Oregon wine potential and what you might see happening in the future for the industry.
I have no clue, man. Yeah, I just kind of try to keep up with, I feel like I just go where the business is. You know, as a sales rep, I see a new place opening and I don't have that vision to think about what's next, but I walk in there, I'm like, oh, that's cool. I haven't seen that before. So I wouldn't call myself the creative one. I would just call myself the annoying salesy one, you know. The sales rep is trying to duck in and cold call on you. But you know, there,
what's the potential you see?
What's the potential I see? Well, the potential I would hope is that you know, we separate ourselves from the shadow of Burgundy, and that's of course what the New World has been trying to do forever. And you know, the Gorge is, of course, a huge potential. A lot of people are talking about Underwood as well. And, you know, I'm kind of curious what Underwood can do, because I guess the price of fruit is going way up in Underwood. So I think that that's a place that I'd like to drink more of. These younger producers farming different spots, like Grape Inc. In the Petit Monde book. I forget his name, but yeah, he's got a...
Jared.
Thank you. Yeah. I've never met him before. I would like to meet him. But his spot is as far north as you could go, and you can see Sauvie Island, or like what Andrew was talking about with planting higher on Parrot Mountain than you've ever gone. And of course, Parrot Mountain, home to some of my favorite wine. Like, I love J.K. Carrier. Have the t-shirt, you know, by Vespide. And Beckham, who I think are just like, Andrew Beckham is like, he's a Jedi. He's the only one who can make the amphora, you know? So seeing more experimental stuff coming out of Parrot Mountain, I cannot wait for, you know, which is a sad thing to not be able to wait for, because it means the world's going to get hotter before we can taste it. But I'm excited for that. And I don't know. Trends are so funny. People are so obsessed with what natural wine, you know, the whole natural wine car crash conundrum is one that I am so sick of dealing with. It's one of the hardest things to interface with consumers about. But at the same time, I'm kind of excited to see the post-natural age come to light, where it's like clean wines, you know, properly sulfured perhaps. And kind of see that swing back to, you know, I don't know, see what comes next. But I don't know what comes next. I often think about that. Like, I'm such a poser. I just get the final product and I get to judge it. And, like, I'm quite a candid salesperson. If I don't really like a wine, you know, I'll say what I mean. Josh will hate to hear this, but I'll say what I think about it. And if I like a wine, I'll say what I think about it. I wear it on my sleeve, and I feel like it's unfair for me to do that because I haven't put in the blood, sweat, and tears to do it. So, that being said, it's always exciting to see what the next vintage of any wine holds, whether it's, you know, and I would prefer that vintages be good and bad rather than the same. So, you know, I kind of, you know, even a producer that I love, I'll kind of enjoy shit talking a vintage sometimes, even though I'll probably bring the wine home and enjoy it, you know. So it's all in good fun. It's all in good fun.
I think that opinion right there makes you an Oregonian. If you like vintage variation, I think that makes you an Oregonian.
Oh, so yeah.
I think you pass.
Good. Pass. Yeah, but I also like 19 Pinot Noir, so I think that makes me an Oregonian as well, yeah. Yeah, 19, 11, 13, I'm that type of a person.
So tell me about, for yourself, obviously you have a role here that you're enjoying, you're doing a little bit of retail on the side. What is next for you? Is there anything you're looking forward to? Any projects on the horizon? Anything that you're kind of aspiring to do, either personally or professionally?
That's a great question. I mean, always becoming more efficient in the way that I sell is super important. I feel like this is a role that you never completely master. And I think that it's really important that you never rest on your laurels. You know, you can get complimented for what you do or something like that, or have someone discover you and interview you, but that doesn't mean that you're done, man. It doesn't mean that you're a good salesperson. You know, you can always perform better. And so I think always working to become a better salesperson, but also, like I said, I feel like such a poser just sitting here and drinking the finished product. Like, I've never, like, I personally love the physical side of the industry. This is another reason why I love distribution so much, is I love, like, coming in the morning. I come in every single morning, build the pallets. I like to think I'm the best pallet jack driver in the warehouse. But I love, like, putting in the sweat too. And that's something that when I was initially hired on, Josh was worried that I would just think that this was a glamour industry. So I remember one of the first days he pointed out a pallet and he said, take that pallet, build it right there. Like, you know, he was like, this is what the wine industry is. And I love that so much more than the glamour side, almost, is like when we get, but that being said, I've never been on the production side. So even if it's just something that I could do on the side, that just tires me out and is like excellent physical work, and just seeing what that's all about. Like, I know in theory what all of these processes are, but I don't think I've ever seen a lot of them, honestly, which is wild to think. But I'd be really interested to do that. But also, I don't want to leave what I'm doing now because I love this so much. And I feel like if I had to stay in one place for an entire day of work, it would kill me. I need to visit all four corners of the city every single week. I need to see what's going on everywhere in the city. I need to keep moving. Like, I'm just, repping has gotten into my body that way, where I just need to go everywhere now. So staying in one room and like cleaning a tank for a long time or something just seems like it might kill me. But I also really, really feel like it's important that I do that in the future as well. But, you know, I'm happy where I am, and I guess I can always dig deeper here or spread out, because that's, like we were talking about before, the beauty of the industry is there are a million things that I don't even know exist yet that I may love more than repping. And you know, I have met a lot of people who can help me discover those things too along the way. And, you know, yeah, a million people I can thank for where I've gotten here. Josh stuck his neck out big time to hire on, you know, someone who he didn't know the potential of at all. And, you know, he put a lot of money and patience into me, because whereas Josh is very by the books, I am sort of the reed of grass that blows in the wind. You know, I kind of let life sway me wherever it's going to go, whereas Josh tries to systematically do everything right. So we've kind of learned around each other over the years, but he's given me the patience and time, and, you know, so many people have helped me out and told me I'm doing a good job and supported me, giving me hookups on wine, whatever, you know. And I feel really, really grateful almost every day that I work in this industry, every day. Yeah.
Well, excellent. All the questions that I have for you. Anything I didn't ask that I should have, or anything we didn't cover?
Man, I can't think of anything. I'm pretty tired of talking. Even a day of sales appointments, I don't talk this much at once. Yeah. So, no. All I can say to everybody out there is, like, drink all the wine that you can. Everything that you haven't tried yet, just go try it. You know, even if you think it's stupid, even if it's like a bottle at Safeway or something, or a weird bottle at grocery outlet, just try it. You never know. I bought these at the Meadow because Cacao is unfortunately closed. It closed during the pandemic, but please go check out craft chocolate and support that industry, just because it's really small, and I see a lot of really genius producers go out of business simply because it's really hard to maintain. So, and I think that a lot of wine fans who like complex flavor profiles will find a vast amount of pleasure there. I buy a lot of my pu'er from a site called unonsourcing.com, and actually there's a unonsourcing.us, which is a much smaller selection. But if you want to dig into this, it's fascinating, ageable tea. There's a whole rabbit hole down there. TDB.org are these two nerds out of Seattle, and they have like a huge database of, you know, learning materials for pu'er. Highly recommend you guys do that. Also, there's a new spot that just opened up right next to Dame called Bardo Tea, and they have a couple pours, and they're super knowledgeable. Go check them out. Fly Awake Tea House, go check them out. And Fly Awake is on just off Mississippi. And yeah, man, check out these other things if you like wine.
That is an excellent plug at the end of this interview. Good job. I'll be another one to say you're doing a good job. And thank you so much, and we'll let you off the hook.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Oregon Wine History Archive podcast. And thank you to all our supporters, partners, donors, and interviewees who have helped make our project a success. Be sure to check out our website at OregonWineHistoryArchive.org for more interviews, photographs, wine labels, and more. And stay tuned for more interviews as we tell the story of Oregon wine. The Oregon Wine History Archive podcast is brought to you from the Oregon Wine History Archive at Linfield University, with a very special thank you to all the Linfield Archive students who have contributed to these oral history interviews over the years.